The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is Ivy Zelman. She is CEO of Zelman & Associates and has nearly 30 years of experience covering housing and housing-related industries. Founded in October 2007, Zelman & Associates provides analyses across all aspects of the housing market and produces hundreds of proprietary research surveys annually. She's frequently quoted in the Wall Street Journal and appears occasionally as a guest on CNBC. And she is noted for having accurately called the top of the housing market in 2005, as well as calling the bottom of the housing market in January 2012. Ivy Zelman lives in Cleveland, Ohio, with her husband David and her three children, Zoe, Zachary, and Zia. Ivy Zelman, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm actually smiling. I like the introduction. My three Z's even got mentioned, so that's exciting.
Well, you know, I don't normally name our guests children, but I thought it was interesting that you provided that end of the alphabet alliteration for your children, and our listeners would appreciate that.
The only thing missing, Mike, was my dog, Zoe, our Australian Shepherd, who I think I love more than the kids, but of course, I'm just kidding.
So your dog's name is Zoe, okay, as well.
Right, that's right.
Now, let me ask you about Cleveland. Some people refer to Cleveland as by the epithet, the mistake by the lake. No doubt you would take exception to that. Tell us about Cleveland just as a place to live.
I certainly didn't, as a little girl, dream someday that I was going to wind up living in Cleveland. But, you know, you do a lot of things when you fall in love. And being a New Yorker and meeting a Clevelander, I fell in love with my husband, and he wanted to raise his family in the Cleveland area where his parents were and his siblings. And kind of like, for those old enough to remember the Cunninghams, you know, Mayberry and all that, it was a very different environment that he convinced me. I went a little bit kicking and screaming, admittedly, 7 months pregnant with now my oldest daughter, who just graduated high school last week, and it's a wonderful place to raise a family. My only gripe is that we only get the sun 4 months a year, so that is a problem, but other than that, it's really a fantastic place to live and a great place to raise children.
I suspect another gripe you might have is that the Cleveland Browns have not been a good team, but Baker Mayfield is going to change everything. Is that true or false?
He already has. It's like, you know, the new beginning, and it's, you know, really the future of this town and is dependent upon him. So the weight of the world is on his shoulders, and I think that, you know, I'm worried. I'm worried for my husband and my son and, you know, everyone that is so pumped and excited that they're getting a little ahead of their skis, but, you know, it's already changed, and the enthusiasm, we're already expecting to go to the Super Bowl, and, you know, jokingly at any dinner, you know, people like, we'll be happy if we're, you know, 4-12, but there's just a lot of excitement and enthusiasm around what Baker's brought to this town.
Yeah, he's an exciting player, and now you guys have picked up Odell Beckham Jr. from the Giants, and so that combination is going to be big this season. I know some football analysts are picking Cleveland to win the division, so it's good to see some good football back in Cleveland. But let's go ahead and get to real estate. Let's talk about the I heard you refer to real estate that you've said in a way the real estate business is a mosaic. And if it's a mosaic, talk about the components of that mosaic, because this is what you study and this is where your reports come from. What's that mosaic composed of?
You know, really all of the pieces of what are considered housing related. And we think of the housing mosaic really more like a puzzle, and being able to, you know, analyze all the pieces as they fit together, and recognizing whether we're talking about, you know, on the front line are your home builders, that you you know, generally they work with land developers, so you have to know what the land development market is doing. And of course, the home builders are working with their suppliers with respect to labor contractors or vendors that are providing the products. We have to know the building products manufacturers and the distributors. Of course, the consumer, if they buy a home, you have to understand the mortgage market, and therefore, as well as mortgage insurance and mortgage title. I think that, you know, if you are buying homes or if you're renting homes, you know, which is the best alternative? So we have to understand the rental market, and that includes single-family rental as well as the apartment rental market. And so when you kind of look at the mosaic, we think about sort of having a complete ability to analyze soup to nuts anything to do with housing, and demographics is sort of the underpinning of all of that. And of course, then you look at all the variables of what drives housing, including employment, consumer confidence, government policy, all of the things that will impact the consumer's ability to buy a home. So, you know, it's what we do and really differentiates us from any other firm out there that focuses on housing, because this is all we do. And we will continue to touch upon anything that is adjacent. For example, we do real estate brokers. I forgot to mention them as part of the mosaic, real estate services, because real estate services includes not only real estate brokers like REMAX or Realogy, but also includes Zillow and Redfin. And there's now the iBuyer market that will continue to grow and be a part of that. So anything that touches housing is in the mosaic.
Now, you've mentioned that that's all you do is housing. You have emphasized that over the years, that you're exclusively focused on the housing market, you don't get into the commercial or industrial market and whatnot. Talk about why you're focused exclusively on the housing market. Is it just a matter of focus, and that the housing market is comprised of so many different components that it requires your full attention?
Well, I think first and foremost, you know, to be really incredible and be an expert in anything, I think it's hard enough to focus on one area. So we recognize that our expertise in residential is so broad to begin with that we are always learning. And so to go beyond our expertise in other areas would dilute, I believe, the quality and the credibility of what we do best today. And you know, we're continuing to look at adjacent opportunities. So, for example, manufactured housing is shelter, and it's residential. So maybe that's an area we would cover. And other opportunities that may exist. But generally, we just feel like to be the best at anything, you really have to focus on, you know, one or two things. And, you know, back to Steve Jobs always said, and if anyone who's read his autobiography would recognize that, you know, making one or two things is hard enough. If you start going into many different areas, I think we all know that that dilutes whatever you're doing very, very well to begin with.
Now, I mentioned at the top that your firm produces hundreds of reports a year. You guys do a lot of research. In fact, you publish more than 800 reports per year. What are these reports? I'm assuming you're doing these. These are proprietary reports. You're doing them for your clientele. What kind of information are produced in these reports?
There's lots of different types of reports, but we'll start with company reports. So as a firm, we are a broker-dealer, and we are regulated by FINRA. So we rate roughly 55 stocks, buy, hold, or sell. And so we're publishing notes on individual companies to provide really the takeaways of our views to either support and or change our views of stock. So sometimes you'll see an upgrade note or a downgrade note where we're changing our rating, or you'll have an earnings note talking about the company's earnings and if they came ahead of our expectations or below our expectations and changing our earnings forecast. So company notes would be one category. We also do a lot of thematic work. So when we called the top of the market back in 2005, we wrote a report called Investors Gone Wild, and that was what we call a thematic report. So we're really supporting why we're concerned about all the investors that were buying homes with no money down on liar loans. We did a report in 2006 called Wonderland. Fast forward to, obviously, Zelman, and we're doing a lot of thematic reports that are not that many necessarily, but very critical because it's really sort of longer term and strategic, a report we did, for example, called The Great Unwind, which was back in 2013, which was really when the mortgage market was arrested and we were seeing credit very, very challenged for consumers. The Great Unwind was a very in-depth report that talked about the mortgage market was going to eventually unwind and reduce those stringencies. And in fact, pretty much right now, mortgage availability is back to more normalized levels. So thematic is another area, and that would really include demographics as well. So we did a report called Leasing the American Dream, and that was really introducing the idea of single-family rental and people's perception that everyone is going to only rent and that ownership was secularly in a spiraling decline, and we refuted that. So thematic, again, being a category. I think we do a tremendous amount of proprietary surveys. The surveys are really the core underpinnings that allow us to take whatever our cycle view is, which is the foundation of what we build upon, and each month, and in some cases quarterly, we're surveying it's close to about 1,000 companies at the C-suite level, their owners and operators in each of the respective silos, whether they're home builder, private companies, building product manufacturers, distributors, and we're aggregating the results of these surveys through an automated platform that we built internally. And each of these surveys may have, you know, hundreds of companies participating that are significant sample sizes within each respective end market. And we aggregate those results. We then triangulate those results to the other pieces of the housing mosaic to help us guide our way and navigate through where we are in a cycle. So, for example, in 2018, we were concerned that our home building survey was showing that things were slowing more than normal month to month sequentially for four consecutive months starting the year. So we downgraded a bunch of stocks and became more cautious, despite the fact that home builders were still reporting year over year double-digit growth in their orders. And in fact, we remained cautious because our surveys were becoming more and more negative in terms of the results, and that actually resulted in 2018 being one of the worst years since the recovery began. But then, positively, our surveys told us that things were starting to pick up and get better, and we upgraded a bunch of stocks and piled on back in March to a more constructive view. And all that time, we believed that it was more of a pause, and it was our survey owner and operators throughout all the surveys that really helped us to stay grounded, and they really are the guardrails that help us navigate where we are in a cycle.
So what are you asking in these surveys? Are you generally asking them whether the demand for a home building, let's take a home builder for example, whether the demand is still strong, whether the homes are moving? Are you basically taking kind of the pulse of what's going on from the view of the C-suite?
Yes. Each survey has, you know, somewhere from, let's just say on average, you know, 15 to 25 questions, depending on the survey. And we try to have a consistent, a consistency in the responses. So even if someone didn't do it one month, we'll go back and get their data. And we actually will take people off research if they don't have the ability to provide the exchange on a consistent basis, because that's the benefit, the mutual exchange, is they provide us their information and they get the research in exchange at no cost. And these C-suite executives are being asked questions like on a year-over-year basis, how much were your orders up in absolute end percentages, how many communities did you open, what are you seeing in your raw material costs with respect to all the various materials that they're using, are they seeing any pressure on gross margins, what's their outlook for gross margins, what's their expectation for land costs, what are land costs doing, every aspect of the business we're asking about. And in some cases, they're answering in a qualitative way that we've created ways to extrapolate the qualitative comments into quantitative series that we can then utilize. So, for example, maybe said differently, on a scale of 0 to 100, if 100 is, you know, the worst and 0 is the best or vice versa and 50 is normal, where do you see the level of incentives today in Cleveland, Ohio, where they operate? And they'll answer questions by their local market, and let's say incentives are really bad at 100, and today the the answer is 64 for them. And each month, they can see their prior month's response. So back in 18, as I referenced earlier, we started seeing a big pickup in incentives. And we also asked questions about cancellation rates and all of the various inputs that will help us determine directionally what's going to happen not only to volumes, but importantly to home prices. And so that's one example. But, you know, for the apartment survey, which has got 1.5 million doors that were basically units that we're aggregating, the questions are very different because we're asking about occupancy levels, new move-in rent growth, renewal rent growth, lease breaks, the ability to what property taxes are doing, if they're increasing and at what magnitude, utility costs. So there's very different questions for each survey, but I think you get the idea, I hope.
I do. So all of this adds up to really taking the temperature of the housing market. So where is it right now, Ivy? You had predicted, you had called the top of the market previously. I've heard some people saying that the housing market is starting to get soft. As you look across the country, where's the housing market right now in the United States? Has it topped out? Is it softening? Is it starting to come down a bit? What does research say?
Well, I think we have to be a little bit more specific, but if I had to generalize at a high level, I'd say the housing market right now is pretty healthy. I think that the higher end of the market, the luxury market, is more challenged. And I think that the affordable market, which there's a shortage, there's not enough affordable housing, is very, very robust. So we talk about a tale of two markets, but today, the United States, the amount of inventory in the market available for sale is actually close to a 30-year low. So it's frustrating for consumers that want to buy a home, especially at the lower price points, because there's very little available inventory. And what is available, in many cases, needs a lot of work because the housing stock is aging. And as the stock is aging, there hasn't been a lot of refurbishment. So we've seen a big trend of house flippers. And those flippers are an important part of the market today that's growing, whether you're watching HGTV and everybody's a flipper, but they're buying these homes and they're fixing them up, allowing people to buy a home that they don't have to refurbish themselves. So the dynamics of the markets, you know, we like to think of the housing market really more at a local level, but today affordability is definitely favorable. Affordability, despite home prices that have been up over 50% since 2011, you still have affordability where I would say it's above average. So today, with consumer confidence overall pretty high and unemployment at record lows, it's really a positive backdrop. But most importantly, it's the demographics, because we have the aging of the millennials and the aging of the boomers, and they have significant important implications for what the direction of housing, what will be the direction of housing. That I'm happy to elaborate, but hopefully it gives you a sense just on the state of the nation right now is pretty healthy.
Well, what can you tell me about this inventory? Why is the inventory so low if the demand is there? I mean, the United States, our free market system is usually pretty good about if there's demand, we create supply. Why is the inventory so low right now?
That's a great question. The inventory right now, and we think about inventories a little differently than a lot of people on how they analyze housing. Inventories, if you look at any home that's listed for sale and you divide it by the number of households, you can derive a trend line. And when we look at inventories divided by households, it's actually at a 30-year low. And people ask why, as opposed to other people that look at the month supply, which you've probably heard of, Mike, where people say, oh, that we have a balanced market if inventories overall are a 6-month supply, because that's dependent on what current sales are doing. And we learned in the downturn very, very quickly and harshly that sales, when they plummet, all of a sudden you have a lot more inventory than you thought. So inventory, for us, we look at it both ways, but more importantly, inventory is as a percent of households. And one of the problems with the market and why it's so tight is that while we have a strong tailwind from millennials who are aging and want to be homeowners, we have a headwind to turnover from boomers that are aging in place. The older we get, the less we move. You know, at my age, you know, I won't say, I guess you could, people probably know, my God, I'm 53. I sound so old, I just can't even say it. So 53, but you're old as you feel, and I feel great, so we'll get back to that. But it, between 50 and 54, roughly on a given year, 9% of people in my cohort in that small little age bracket move a year. That compares to people that are aged between, let's say, 20 and 24, 53% move a year. So really, as we age, we tend to age in place. And the older we get, the longer we stay. So we've got roughly 75 million baby boomers. So that is a headwind. That's the first reason. The second reason is that because of the great housing bust of 2007's, you know, overall peak in housing, we had tremendous amount of distressed inventory. And back to that number I referred to, it inventories now at a 30-year low. Inventories were at a, you know, record high back in 2007. So as these inventories started coming down, a lot of them were distressed sales that were purchased by either individuals that decided to rent them out, or by professional buyers that became actually public companies that bought them to rent them out, and that's called the single-family rental market. Mm. So that market, where cash flows are actually very attractive, they have, we call it the new old thing. The single-family rental market has created a impediment to turnover, because there is very strong cash flows and there's more staying power. And then third and lastly, it's really where rates are today. With rates, despite the recent decline we've seen in mortgage rates, if you think about mortgage rates, unfortunately, are not transferable. So if you refinance your home and you are locked in below a 4% mortgage rate, which many in this country, fortunately, have done so, and you think about moving and mortgage rates are a lot higher, that's going to be an impediment. So actually, statistically, it's pretty disconcerting, because if you think about the number of people that have a mortgage rate below 5% nationally, it's roughly 80%. So while mortgage rates just fell below 4%, which is great, and more people are taking advantage of that opportunity, especially as we see a pickup in housing right now that's continued to accelerate even while the spring selling season usually winds down. We're seeing it continue to actually remain very strong right now, again, with the exception of luxury to the same extent. But if rates were to go back up over 5%, I think it would really slow that discretionary buyer. Because discretionary buyers are, you know, call it two-thirds of the market, or, you know, roughly. So in real estate, you know, brokers like to say the only time in a recession people buy homes, or sell homes, sorry, are the three Ds. Three Ds of real estate are death, divorce, and default. So you're always going to have transactions, but in recessions, it's the three Ds, because you eliminate the fourth D, which is discretion. As a discretionary buyer, if their mortgage rate is going to be at some point 6%, we're going to have a lot of people that are going to be unwilling to move because they can't transfer that mortgage. So those are the three main reasons why inventories remain so tight. And we can probably go into more detail, but a long-winded answer, but that's how I'd summarize it.
Well, you know, we've been waiting for a downturn for a long time. Not that we want a downturn, but a lot of people have felt that this has been a long expansion, and we feel like we're on the precipice in a lot of ways. Do you see any red flags in the housing market right now? Any indicators that are telling you that a downturn is in the offing or even imminent?
You know, I would say, really think that there are some yellow flags, you know. So, you know, when you think about where we are in the economic cycle, I think that, you know, there's no question that we're late in the economic cycle. We're called 9-10 years in the economic cycle, called 7+ years in the housing cycle. So, you know, there are things that concern us from a yellow flag perspective, but we start to think a lot about affordability, making that more late cycle, especially, as I mentioned, the sensitivity around mortgage rates. And the other issue that's a red flag is the level of consumer debt. Consumer debt, inclusive of credit cards, auto debt, and student loan debt, are impediments for many to capture the American dream of home ownership. And with debt service being very low right now because rates are so low, that is somewhat of an offset. But we also know that the consumer doesn't have as much discretionary really spending ability, because if you look at the non-discretionary components for the consumer, and that's everything from, you know, food, transportation, utilities, healthcare, shelter, healthcare is just exponentially above income growth. And that's really eating into consumers' discretionary spending. So there are things that we're watching, because you can't just look at one thing when it comes to affordability. For example, back in 2012, the affordability index that a lot of people use and focus on, which is one variable, it was at record levels of affordability, but the housing market just wasn't getting better. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that the mortgage market was very tight. And our mortgage survey, which we do, and roughly we capture about 20% of mortgage originations in the country, back to our scale, our 0 to 100, you know, if you can fog a mirror, it was a 0 to get a mortgage, and 100, you can't get a mortgage. And back in 2012, it was around 80, whereas today it's back to 54, and so that's pretty close to normal. The other yellow flag, which we're really probably most concerned about, because we can't predict interest rates, would be what may happen with GSE reform. As we know, with the new director of FHFA coming at the helm with ideas and changes that could have, you know, significant implications for the availability of mortgage credit. So that's something that we're going to have to watch very, very closely. And then just lastly, you know, you can't help but watch what happens with the stock market and what's happening with global uncertainties and trade wars and what other political uncertainty we have with an election coming in 2020. All of these things will impact the housing market. But the most important variable to really calling the housing market is about consumer confidence. And without confidence in the asset class, I think the formula for success doesn't exist. And that's why it didn't matter in 2010, 9, 10, 11, that affordability was at record levels. It was people didn't have confidence in the asset class. And now we do. People love housing again, and people want to buy again. And the American dream is alive and well. In fact, home ownership rates have been up consecutively for the last 2 years, and are now back. Home ownership rates are back over 64%.
Now, earlier you mentioned the iBuyer market. What is the iBuyer market?
Actually, it's a market that's creating liquidity for homeowners. So iBuyer stands for instant buyer. What we have are professional companies that have started offering consumers all cash for their homes within days after they submit pictures, and they have algorithms that determine what they think the right value is for those homes, and they'll offer cash, and depending on the seller, they may close in a few days or they may close in 90 days. But the liquidity that they're providing consumers is really what is dramatically changing possibly how people buy and sell homes. And there are companies that are valued in the billions that started organizations just in the last few years. And then you have Zillow, who just recently announced that they're going to be in the flipping business or being an iBuyer business as well. So it's a growing business. There's a significant number of companies that are already participating and more that are starting to participate. But I'd say that it's a market today that is growing exponentially. And the consumers are not really that aware of it. When I mention it at cocktail parties or sporting events or concerts, and people are like, what? And I think what it's going to allow for, which is a great thing, is for that, you know, family of three that is their houses, unfortunately, they've grown out of it and they want to buy this brand new home, but they can't sell it that easily, and they've got to get a real estate broker, and then, oh my God, we got to clean it. Kids have to put away their toys. It's a pain in the butt. You know, you wind up having just a lot of aggravation, or the realtor tells you, you know, you've got to fix up the kitchen, you've got to put in new flooring, you've got to fix the cabinets, the bathroom doesn't look good. And so consumers that don't want to deal with that aggravation and they want to just move quickly, or they are relocating and they want to move quickly, I think there's going to be this is a market that, you know, will have, you know, some penetration. How big will it be? That's yet to be determined. But the question I have for the iBuyer model, business model, is let's say in an up market it works great, and it's in a homogeneous marketplace where all the homes kind of look the same and are under, let's say, $500,000 on average at a lower price point. But what happens when the market's softer and it's harder for those companies to sell those homes? And it's easy to buy them. Is it easy to sell them? And what's the risk to the, you know, the business model? And I think the perception that a lot of the investment community has is it's going to be tough, and it's a capital-intensive business. So for the consumer, it's great. Is it a great business model? I think that's yet to be determined, at least through a recession.
Now, I have heard you say in a previous interview that the build-to-rent market is accelerating. So talk a little bit about the build-to-rent market, exactly what it is and why it's accelerating.
Sure. So during the crisis, roughly 5 million people lost their homes to foreclosure, and that was obviously catastrophic for many families, and they wound up moving across the street to a home that looked pretty similar to theirs, perhaps priced through a rental. And I think that the rental market today for single-family homes equates to about 12% of households, or roughly 15 million households are renting homes. But unfortunately, there is the occupancy through our single-family rental survey is running close to 97%. And rents are inflating anywhere from, call it, 3 to 5% or higher, depending on the market you're in. And the turnover is pretty low at, call it, you know, 30% roughly are turning a year, which is well below the apartment market where turnover is, you know, call it normally in that 50% range, although it's very low right now, it's called 40% range. For that reason, as we talked about earlier, I mentioned there's a lack of available affordable housing, or just a lack of housing. We have a deficit of housing. We believe the shortage in single family equates to about a 25% deficit of what we need just to incrementally shelter the number of people that are forming households and any homes that get demolished that need to be replaced. So what we see is an opportunity that, you know, builders are capitalizing on, where they are building in phases and they recognize that, you know, within their communities that they're offering homes for sale, that they can actually also sell homes to either a rental operator, a company that is already in the business of doing single-family rental communities that are existing homes, so that they actually are building brand new homes. And I think it's going to continue to grow because builders themselves, even some have a hybrid model where they'll retain the assets themselves and rent them out to generate a countercyclical cash flow for themselves. And, you know, we see that potentially being an offset for them if they're having difficulty selling homes that they might have built on speculation. We also are seeing some big companies like Toll Brothers, for example, just announced on their recent conference call that they're partnering with a company called BB Living, which is a company that is a single-family rental operator, who will partner with Toll Brothers, who will be the developer and builder of a single-family home. They're starting in Phoenix, but they'll expand beyond Phoenix, and they will build homes, and then the operator, BB Living, will actually will rent those homes and be the operator to manage and operate those communities. So it's a trend because consumers want new homes. In fact, Zillow did a survey a few years ago that was really well done. It was 13,000 questions, people, 160 questions. And the one that resonated with me was when they asked the question, you know, what's the most important characteristics for millennials when they think about buying a home? And the answer was they want a new home, brand new. And they want amenities. And we know today that we are a community of consumers that we want amenities, we want entertainment, we want service. And what's not available is our new homes. And that's where the deficit, the gap is so significant. So I think you're going to see more and more companies, maybe not necessarily public home builders like Toll Brothers, but I do think you'll see more private home builders, which represent, call it 60% of all new homes built, will continue to see this as an opportunity to provide what's desperately needed for people that may not want to buy or can't get approved in a mortgage or just want flexibility and don't want to be, you know, settled into what might be the next, you know, 10, 15 years of ownership.
So buyers want new homes, which brings to mind smart homes. Do they want new homes? You mentioned amenities. Well, some of the new amenities these days happen to be solar panels so that the heating and cooling costs are low. There's Google Home, there's Alexa, there's a lot of security measures that are built into some of these smart homes, and also the whole Internet of Things concept, appliances and lighting and whatnot that can be operated through voice command, also through smartphones while you're away from home, perhaps on vacation or whatever. Does that factor into that as well? Is there a lot of talk about smart homes? And beyond that, Ivy, do you see smart homes as playing a significant role in the market, or is it still a very small portion of that market?
Well, I'd say the public builders and many of the larger private builders that are part of our network are certainly offering smart homes, and it's a small, you know, percent today of what's, I think, being offered to consumers, but it's really where the direction of the market's going to continue to evolve. And whether, you know, you're talking to Amazon or Apple or Google, all of these large tech companies are focused on housing as a very important asset class that they want to penetrate. We had Amazon speak at our conference last year. We know the people at Apple and even Facebook is getting into housing. So I think that what we see today is really an untapped massive marketplace for technology. And there is going to be significant disruptions, and smart homes certainly, I think, is what the younger generation wants today. You know, it's funny when, you know, you and I think about our homes. You know, I live in my home. It's 15 years in Cleveland. We built this home that we live in. And, you know, if we were to sell it, you know, people would look at it and think, my God, it's so dated. Even a 15-year-old home. If we look and analyze the number of homes listed for sale in the United States in 2018, roughly 60% were 20 years or older. 30% were over 50 years old. And what unfortunately you have is a mismatch. You've got these dated homes that don't have the technology, don't have the services, the Alexas or the Nests and the internet ability where you're Wi-Fi certified everywhere in your house. There's no dead spots. That's like the most important thing, by the way, is every single place in your house has to be Wi-Fi certified. That's something that Lennar offers as a feature, and it's a big selling point. And as we all know, when we have a dead spot, we all want to, you know, just pull our hair out. But I think that what the challenge we'll have as a you know, a country in the housing market today is take a stock that's now, call it 45 years old. A lot of it, even much older than that, if you go east of the Mississippi versus west of the Mississippi, is not what the consumer wants. And a lot of the homes, when they get listed for sale, they're trying to sell it at this aspirational price that is just not going to be what the consumer is willing to pay. And that's especially when you get to the higher end of the market, where you go into the Greenwiches of the world and New York City and other places where it's really tough and prices are headed lower. And I think that's some of the challenges that we're going to see, a lot of it because the millennials want new and they want those smart homes.
So let's stick with millennials for a minute. What have millennials done to the housing market, and what are they going to do as they mature? Because a lot of people talk about millennials in the regard that they like to rent, they're not interested in buying, they're very mobile. But a lot of other people say, well, that's just an effect of their age at the time. As they get older, they are going to be making an impact on the single family housing market or the condo and townhome market. What do you see the millennials, their impact in terms of the housing market? And go ahead and bifurcate it if you can. You've got the rental market, and then you've got the home buying market. So where are the millennials at now, and where are they going to be as they mature?
all about lifestyle for us. You know, we think about, you know, the millennials at different stages in their lives have different needs and different types of shelter. So when you're in your 20s, assumingly you're more likely to be single. And today, as we see people delaying marriage and delaying family formation, the more likelihood it would be that they would be in a rental situation. We looked at where households live between the ages of 18 and 39. And looking at single-family homes, interestingly, I bet you'd be surprised to know that about 38% of households live, or sorry, 38% of people in that age bracket live in a single-family home.
That
if they're
surprising.
Single.
Yeah, that is surprising. And
that doesn't mean they own it. They could rent it. But when we think about what happens when you get married and then you start having children, by the time you're married with two kids, 82% live in a single-family home. Now, that's not suggesting, again, they all own. But the changes in asset class is really, I believe, dependent upon what's going on in your life, and that married and having children is a big factor in it. So what we're seeing today, as the millennials are now in, we believe, in the mid-30s and are in that period of their life where they are getting married and having children, we're seeing a incremental upward trajectory in single family for owned in the asset class. Whereas if you were to look at the trajectory in multifamily for rent or single family for rent, it's actually slightly trending downward. So where people choose to move. So I think the future is really going to be more need for single family to own for sale. But I do think that's because we, as millennials, are aging into that getting married and starting family age bracket. We look at those people that are aged 35 to 44 are actually growing year over year and will continue to be accelerating in growth through 2030, whereas those aged 20 to 24, by 2030, are actually going to be shrinking. So you have to think about age cohorts and tie it to lifestyle to really appreciate which asset class is going to be accelerating and where you might see some downward pressure.
Let's talk about how the housing market is going to change in coming years, and say, based on demographics you were talking about, here we are, baby boomers, we tend to age in place, but then there's also the psychographics to take into account, millennials who have a different sense of lifestyle. We see urbanization going on. We see people wanting to be near transit hubs and so on. You were mentioning a lot of people want new homes and they want a lot of amenities. So if you were to look at the housing market today and then project out, say, 10 or 15 years, Ivy, how's the housing market going to change based on the trends you're seeing?
So one of the things that we are seeing now for the first time this cycle, really starting in, call it 2016, was a move to the exurbs, which is the furthest away from the job center. In fact, the Brookings Institute shows that the population growth is the strongest and growing at on a pretty steep upward trajectory, the strongest in the exurbs. So, you know, you start with urban, which is closest to the city or is in the city of the employment center, and then you go to the suburbs, and then you go to sort of the next suburban step further, and then finally the exurbs. And interestingly, the population is actually shrinking in the urban core, and you're seeing a sort of stable in suburbia and growth in the exurbs. So builders are finally pioneering again and willing to build in those exurb markets. And the reason that they're willing to do that is they have confidence now that consumers will actually drive to qualify. And back in 2013, 14, 15, builders just didn't have not only the confidence, but the mortgage market wasn't necessarily that friendly. The banks weren't willing to lend on assets that far out. There were a lot of reasons that the exurbs and what has historically just been sprawl really was stuck. And I think today the sprawl will be the future. And we as a nation have always had sprawl. I can make you laugh and tell you back in 1985 when I moved from New York to Northern Virginia, and I was living in a place called Herndon, which was near Reston and Dulles Airport, my friends from New York told me that's where the Cowboys and Indians live. And I'm absolutely insane to move there. And as we all know, you know, 30 years, 40 years later, we're talking about, you know, a thriving A market, a, you know, what's considered to be sort of a, you know, the first ring of the, of, or even an A location where there is a job center in Tyson's Corner. So I think the future is that we're going to have sprawl again. We're going to have sprawl. With that said, though, I also believe in cities that are just, you know, unaffordable, whether they're New York City, San Francisco, Chicago, we're going to have more co-living, more options for young adults that come in for jobs to find opportunities to reduce some of those affordability challenges. And, you know, there are companies today in the rental market that really started in Europe, and they're starting up in the U.S. now, and they what they call common living or co-living, or instead of WeWorks, it's WeLive. And I think that's going to be a trend because people do want to walk to work when they're single. But, you know, I believe the American dream is alive and well. And as soon as you start having, you know, kids, you're going to want the backyard and you're going to want the great schools, because unfortunately our urban markets don't offer the same education for children that are offered in the suburban markets. And schools are one of the most important variables that will drive people from those urban cities to the sprawling markets of the suburbs and the exurbs.
Our guest has been Ivy Zelman. She's CEO of Zelman & Associates, a firm that is concerned with all things housing. And the housing market has just been a boon to investors. The multifamily market in particular has just been a rocket. And we look forward to more of that. And Ivy, we look forward to checking in with you along the way here. The amount of research that your firm is doing, we're going to be very interested in tapping into that. So I very much appreciate you taking the time and visiting with us.
Appreciate the opportunity. It's been a lot of fun, Mike, and go Browns.